Put that coffee down. Coffee's for closers only.
This is a Character Animation Bootcamp private class podcast, a cavalcade of character animation wisdom for your cranium. I first became aware of the animator and director Mike Roberts when his short film Rumble Seat hit Vimeo and was a Vimeo staff pick. That was such an amazing short film. I was struck by the visual style, the animation style, and I could see that he was doing things with After Effects that were beyond the work that I was doing at the time, and I just thought it was a really exciting and interesting piece. Later, he joined up with the terrific Shadow Machine, which is an LA-based animation studio, and you would know them if you spend any time watching Adult Swim and you've seen Trip Tank. BoJack Horseman is another Shadow Machine production, among others. You should definitely check out their website and see all the things that Shadow Machine are involved with. They're a wonderfully diverse studio, and they do a lot of 2D character work. And Mike is one of their best directors. Mike and I sort of circled each other for several years. I was contacted by a couple of his producers to potentially work on some of his projects. He wasn't really even all that aware of me. His producers, I think, had just found me in some Google searches. And I was unfortunately unable to work on those projects because I was already booked at the time. And I was heartbroken because I loved his work and I really wanted to participate in the projects. But I kind of kept my eye on Shadow Machine and Mike's work, and I was incredibly flattered when a few years later he sent me on his own a wonderful little note just saying that he'd seen some of my work and had enjoyed some of my work, and I couldn't have been more flattered because I really admire Mike so much. So we began a really pleasant correspondence, and I did finally get a chance to do a little work for Mike and Shadow Machine. I built them a rig template, a 2D character rig that could actually turn smoothly in space, and it was something that I'd been working on for a while. They had need of something similar, and I was super excited to be able to pitch in and help them out with that. Mike is a terrific guy, and I really hope you enjoy this conversation with the brilliant animation director, Mike Roberts. Okay, well, Mike Roberts, thanks so much for talking to us. Let's start kind of back at the beginning. How did you get into doing 2D character animation?
Well, I started out, I guess I was one of those guys who kind of always drew since he was a little kid, and it was all I wanted to do. And I think from about 5 years old to probably 14, I wanted to be a comic book artist, which is probably what, I'm sure a lot of people have that same thing if they're into drawing when they're a kid.
Yeah.
And then I got into film arts in high school, which was like essentially a class where they made music videos on VHS tapes, and it was super fun. I really liked it. And he'd kind of go through like the chase scene from Bullet and some sort of important film moments that he thought were important. The teacher was amazing, a guy named Jim Ziegler. And he sort of said, why don't you go to Sheridan College? Because I sort of lived down the street. I didn't mention I'm from Canada originally. And so he said, good, well, you should get into classical animation. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized it was this crazy program that was super hard to get into. And I didn't think I had much of a chance. But I, after a couple of tries, I got in there and became very traditionally trained. And by that, I mean without any digital, without any digital understanding of anything. It was just paper and pencils, which was great. I mean, it was really great.
Yeah.
And from there, basically got a job after school, realized that nothing is traditional anymore. This was probably about 2000. So I had this great kind of formal training and absolutely no technical training.
Oh, interesting.
And the first job I got was, well, one on a show called Angela Anaconda, which was like After Effects, but done in Houdini, which is sort of like, killing a fly with a machine gun.
Yeah.
And then the second one was a show called Hoobs, which was a Jim Henson puppet show that had these 2-minute segments. And one of the guys said, hey, let's not do this in Houdini. Let's do it in After Effects. And it kind of made it so we could just do these 2-minute episodes. Like one artist every 2 weeks would kind of pump out these little shorts. Mm-hmm. And that was my kind of After Effects crash course.
Oh, cool. Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, who were some of your early heroes? Who were some of your early... You said you were sort of more of a comic book guy.
Yeah.
Did you was it more was it more kind of comic book artists that you were inspired by, or were there animated films or cartoons that you were into as well?
Well, I think I think like everybody, I loved the Disney movies and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But there became that kind of jaded teen period where I was a teenager right when Disney was at its most sort of musical 2D with Aladdin and The
sure.
Lion King and all that, and it felt, I kind of understood how important and hard it was to do that, but it felt old-fashioned and uninteresting to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was definitely more into Dave Stevens, the comic mm-hmm. book artist,
yeah.
or Mike Allred, or these kind of, you know, guys who reminded me of, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, Lidecker, you know, like that old style of...
Yeah.
of illustration, and that was always what inspired me was sort of the storytelling, and I loved the storytelling aspects of comics, but I felt like the printed page ended up being very limited.
Right.
I mean, you're kind of limited in two directions. If you love comics, you're limited by how still things are. If you love animation, you're limited by how prolific you have to be to create mm-hmm. content, and
right.
That's sort of where After Effects comes in, because you can skip the whole 824 drawings per second stage and actually get quantities done, which is what interests me.
Yeah, sure. That was a really interesting way to look at it. When you were learning character animation there at Sheridan, and I know it's an amazing program, but what did you feel was the most difficult thing to learn? I mean, obviously the drawing is a huge kind of component in that type of work, but in focusing more on the movement.
I think to be honest, what always killed me was how, like, when you're learning classical animation at that level, in order to become a good enough character designer that you can design a character that you can then animate and be productive when you animate, a character that you can draw and then animate with any speed, you have to make such a, like, I'm kind of stuttering through this
That's
part.
That's all right.
In order to kind of design a character that you can actually practically animate takes a lot of skill.
Right.
So you're almost too young or inexperienced to be designing characters at a level that you can draw them and still like them mm-hmm. on this mass scale. So I felt like that was really frustrating, is getting performance from characters that you liked the way they looked was
right.
always felt
right.
like a compromise.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
So, I mean, that was what was hard for me. I mean, performance is super important, and getting characters to feel right and seem developed, I think, is a really important and hard skill to learn. And that was always something that you're constantly throwing your drawings away because it's not good enough. And sometimes the only way to learn from that drawing is to crumple it up and throw it away and start again.
Sure.
So that was always the hardest part to me, is by the time I'd finish my animation, I would be a better designer and a better animator in that one, you know, 10-second animation I just did, and then it kind of all had to be thrown away and started again.
Right. Right.
So I don't know if answers the question. It was always, performance is hard. I mean, I would say, particularly animation. Let me say that again. I don't like animating because I don't like the job I do. Like, I don't think I'm a good enough animator to do the job I want. Like, how it won't come out the way I want it to look.
Right.
That makes any sense? So I'm always, like, excited now that, you know, getting into direction, that other people are better than me at animating.
Right.
Like that was the part that was missing. You know, I like designing, I like storyboarding and structure and all that kind of stuff. But the classical animation I would look at as my, you know, I have to do it rather than I want to do it. Because people who make it their craft spend their whole lives getting good at it.
Right. Well, that's interesting, talking about the difficulty in creating performance in a classical hand-drawn setting, you know, because of, just like you said, you have to be so good at the drawing aspect, and it's so time-consuming.
Mm-hmm.
Moving into After Effects, can you talk a little bit about how that changes that equation a little bit in approaching how you build those performances when you're now working with a puppet rather than frame by frame drawing?
Yeah, well, what I like about it is you can, in similar to 3D, you can maintain the look. So once you've established a look and you're there, you can say, okay, well, at the very least, it's always going to look like this. And
right.
then you know, you have to work against the fact that the rigs will break and do things that aren't aesthetically pleasing. But right. Worst case scenario, that body's going to look like that and that face is going to look like that. So, you know, it's a bit of a compromise to get there, but it's a less of a compromise than what you have to do to make classical animation practical at speed.
Right,
you know?
Right. Yeah, for sure.
But that's what I mean. That's what I really like about After Effects is you build these rigs and making the character becomes part of the fun. Like getting right. to the final, getting a character in a rig you're happy with becomes part of the challenge,
mm-hmm.
Which makes, I think, the whole production a little more fun because mm-hmm. character design, sometimes you, from my experience, you make a character and you're happy with the way it looks and you hand it out to a team and that team has to then interpret it and you're at the mercy of what their skill set is and what right. their... tastes are.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this way you can hand a character off and say, okay, this is how it's going to look.
Yeah.
Here are the constraints. And if you break it, we got to figure out a plan. But at least in the meantime, it's going to look a certain way.
Right.
And then you have clients who are happy because they signed off on something and received that back from
yes.
animation.
Yes. Yeah. Hear, hear to that. that's been a huge improvement in my work life too. When did you start getting into directing? Like how far along in your career did you start moving into directing?
Well, I took this weird detour into motion graphics from, you know, which is, in a sense, it's very far from classical animation, even though the principles are there. And I yeah. always feel like the best motion graphics guys kind of understand classical principles like bouncing balls and weight and,
yeah.
you know, they call it seaweed when we did it, but it's basically a moving S-curve, you know.
Right, sine waves, yeah.
What's that?
Sine waves.
Yeah,
S-I-N-E sine waves, yeah. waves, yeah.
Totally, so I took this this weird kind of, I ventured into classical animation, I ventured into motion graphics because I felt like I had a bit of a leg up because mm-hmm. the stuff ended up feeling more finished than what a lot of the other people were doing because of these classical animation principles. So I sort of climbed that ladder pretty quick doing titles and graphics for commercials and, you know, the Chevy would drive by and then I'd animate the logo kind of boop above mm-hmm. it. And it felt kind of like a lot of payoff. You got to see your stuff on TV and it was really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there I went, I got a job doing titles and kind of designs for a guy named Ron Mann, who's a documentary filmmaker and he's really experimental in how he presents his ideas. So he kind of like let me go crazy, with designing stuff for that. So I went into this motion graphics world only to kind of come back essentially to directing because I was in charge of these huge portions of these films.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just became, you know, I guess I had I forgot to mention that at one point I got into doing a lot of storyboarding for a company called Cup of Coffee Animation in Toronto.
Oh, sure. I remember them. Yeah.
Yeah. And I worked on Henry's World and, Jojo's Circus. And,
oh,
and
great.
By the time I'd finished on Jojo's Circus, I was essentially doing all the boards for the show with my team.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I kind of felt like, well, wait a minute. Storyboarding is essentially directing.
Yeah.
So I started getting more and more into handling these things. And I was kind of lead animator and I would be finishing this whole thing going, well, wait a minute. I'm taking this from script all the way to post. Why am I just animating? Like, how is this kind of what I'm doing? And then I said, okay, I guess I have to kind of draw a line in the sand here if I'm going to be a director, which seemed to be what I wanted to do from there in.
Right, right.
So from there, basically, I said, well, I got to stop and just make a film.
Mm-hmm.
And that ended up being essentially the only difference is I had a film in my pocket. So now I'm a director, you know.
Right.
I could
right.
have stayed as this lead animator, essentially doing the same job forever.
Right, right.
But
yeah.
But you have to kind of draw a line in the sand and that was sort of make a film and then move to Los Angeles, basically.
Was that Rumble Seat?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great, great.
Yeah,
oh, cool.
So that was you know, that was really great because a bunch of things came together because I had a great relationship with a band called the Sadies,
mm-hmm.
and I had a sort of good relationship with this director and a producer in Toronto who kind of vouched for me to get a grant. So I had this like basically an amount of money that covered costs. You know, I'm sure that the actual money I probably spent was 3 or 4 times the grant, but it just made it so that it was like there was a number and I could point to it.
Right.
It was like a film with a budget rather than me just doing it on evenings and weekends. And it meant I could pay for sound design and, you know, all this kind of stuff that ends up, it's a weird barrier for entry, making sure that it's polished, you know?
Right.
So, and then from there, I went to a bunch of film festivals, and that was great. I mean, I had a lot of fun at film festivals. And
yeah.
It played at a bunch, like a lot, but Rumble Seat's weird because it looks like animation, definitely, but it doesn't look like what an animation block at a film festival thinks is animation. Mm-hmm. And it also doesn't look like a regular film, obviously, but it is as kind of, I don't know how to say it, cinematic might not be the right word, but it's as, you know, lighting and shadows and dark. So it kind of plays more into a narrative film way. So when I get into a film festival and they just would program it randomly, it seemed to do really well. And then if I get in an animation block, they'd be like, I don't know what this is. And there'd be a judge who'd say, well, it's not really animated.
Because
it's this puppet style. And,
oh, geez.
Which was funny because that was kind of by design. I mean, I said, like, look, I'm a director here making this film. I'm not an animator. So anytime I could make something limited and still and quiet, I sort of chose to do that. So the focus was off of character animation. You know, his performance is always important, but I made this film that was kind of a collection of shots, so it never really hurt my feelings if someone was like, well, it's not well animated, because that was sort of by design, but anyway, the thing about that is, so I'm in all these film festivals, and I think, oh, I'm getting there, I'm somebody, I'm in film festivals, that's what the world says is the thing, and then finally I just posted it to Vimeo after a year. You know, I spent thousands of dollars going to film festivals. I posted it to Vimeo, and probably within a couple of months, it got a staff pick, which I don't know how that happens. There's some glue there, and one day you get a little badge, and they say congratulations, and then you get 100,000 views.
Right.
But what that did is it meant a manager from L.A. called me, and I was living in New York at the time, and they said, hey, I want to be your manager. Come to LA. And I was like, oh, all right. So I kind of did, you know, and then it was funny because it ends up in that I think is a funny thing about me. If I'd thrown it up on Vimeo and done a little promotion,
right,
that might've all happened a year earlier and I might've saved $4,000 or $5,000 in hotels. And, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's amazing how Vimeo has changed the equation. It really has become so vitally important for people communicating and finding each other. It's really kind of changed the game in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I look at reels on Vimeo all the time for people to hire.
Right.
You know, a good reel on Vimeo is a hell of a lot more important than any other way you can show what your skill set is to me.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. That's great. That's a real golden nugget for the folks listening to this. That's fantastic. Now that you've moved into directing, and you were kind of talking before about how, in a lot of ways, you would kind of rather be doing that than the actual animation. Do you still get to do a certain amount of character animation, or do you still do quite a bit yourself, or?
Yeah, no, I have a great team who does the majority of the animation for sure now, and I sort of jump in on the stuff that either I maybe can't communicate or something that needs a different look, or you know, often I'm just trying to help out getting deadlines met.
Yeah,
but I do a lot of the rigging and a lot of the stuff that. It's funny because ironically, the rigging ends up being very technical, get it done kind of part of the process. Mm-hmm. So it seems ironic that maybe the director would be doing the rigging, but what it does is it helps out for people because it takes so much time to learn this stuff, you know, what expression goes here to link to this and how to navigate the stuff that doesn't work.
Right.
That it ends up being one of those things where me spending an hour could be 2 days of another person doing it.
Right. Yeah.
And so in a weird way, I can kind of help out. So my time ends up being like planning, taste, and then building these rigs and handing them off to people to animate and then deciding what's good, what's finished, what's not, what we can get away with on our time.
Sure. You know? Sure. Right.
It seems like, you know, everyone, it's funny, when I meet people who ask me what my job is, and the quickest way to say is just someone to make choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you realize like how much of the process is someone coming to a standstill, because it seems like everyone's job gets broken when probability gets brought into it. So someone will come up and say, okay, I've got to draw a hat. Is the hat green, purple, blue, red? Okay, I'm a person who knows that green looks good there, go. And then you keep doing these things where you're constantly faced with these choices. And then when you get to a wall, it's essentially the director's job to figure out how they're to make sure there are no walls to production.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
So it's like if you're someone who just loves to the character performance, that's what you should focus on and find a way to make the kind of money you need at a company that wants to pay you to focus on that. But if you're the kind of person who wants to make these broad choices, then that sort of that's what I would say is like someone who wanted to decide how to be a director. It's like, do you like that stress you get from being faced with stressful choices that have to be answered and living by that? You know, a lot of people just end up they don't want to do that. They don't want to be on the hook.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. No, I totally understand that. Yeah. Yeah. So you mostly use After Effects, as you've talked about. Are there other tools that you use in your productions?
Yeah, I mean, I use everything I get my hands on. The main reason I would say I use After Effects 90% of the time is because After Effects is your last stop.
Mm-hmm.
Because I use a lot of Element 3D. I'm sure everyone on the internet who's touched After Effects knows about Video Copilot and Andrew Kramer. And he's sort of one of those things where I joke about it. It's like the Force in Star Wars. You know, there's two sides. You can go and learn these incredible lessons from this guy, or you can kind of become a minion of his style, and it turns you into a guy that just does what he does.
Yes.
So in a weird way, like you see it all the time where it's just kind of versions of stuff he does. But if you're willing to kind of riff on it and treat it more like jazz, you know, like he's this amazing guy who gives you this incredible tool set. And the reason I bring that up is because I use Element so much that sometimes I feel like a disciple of his, you know?
Right.
But what it is he's done this thing where he's given you the ability to add 3D into your workflow.
Right.
And I'm using Element as an example, by the way. Like,
sure.
Element is the perfect program to stay inside of After Effects as much as you can.
Right.
And what that means is if you have a shot that's finished, you don't have to worry about compositing it. It's done. So, you know, my team laughs at me because my compositions will sometimes have 15 cameras and 25 lights because I'm basically setting up cameras in shots sequentially. So I'll have a puppet that needs a long shot, a wide shot, a medium, another angle, up, down, sideways, and I'll set those all up in one comp because I know that that's all being in one, or that all exists in one render.
Right, right. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's probably not the best way to do it, but what it does for me is it means that if the light looks right and the vignette looks right and the texture looks right, I don't have to do it six times or set up, because I'm not the kind of person who likes to set up presets. And I mean, I do, but I hate it because I feel like that's where the technical gets in the way of the creative. Right. And I like to think of everything as just sitting out on a table and I get to move everything once.
Right.
So I try to, like, every scene gets one setup in my head. And every time I have to subdivide that, it's better for rendering, it's better for tracking. It doesn't always work good for the workflow, but it definitely gives you a product that you can say that will consistently look like that throughout. That's what I love about After Effects. I mean, I see a lot of workflows where they're using Flash and Photoshop and this and that, and then they finally have to end up in After Effects. And if you started from the beginning planning in After Effects, it just would save so much time. But, like, you know, that means I use Cinema 4D and Illustrator and Photoshop. And literally, I'm dabbling in Storyboard Pro just because it's so well laid out.
Yeah, yeah. Do you ever use Toon Boom?
I have. Here's what happened. Someone showed me Toon Boom Harmony's character rigging, and I went, oh, that's the best thing I've ever seen. And then they showed me the price, and I was like, maybe I'll wait.
Yeah. Right.
So apparently it's come down a lot in price, but it is pretty amazing. It's sort of like all the problems with Duik and character puppet rigging in After Effects seems to be kind of handled.
Yes, yes. Although I have to say that in my experience, the user interface leaves a fair amount to be desired, and I think that, in combination with the fact that when you're working in After Effects, you're kind of in sync with everybody else that's already in the Adobe universe, That's sort of why I still kind of come back to After Effects, even though Toon Boom has some really cool features. But it's sort of like once you're in Toon Boom, you're in the Toon Boom universe.
Well, and that's what that's the thing is I can always, if someone could say, okay, listen, we're going to give you Toon Boom and it's going to be your last stop, yeah. I'd be like, well, maybe we'll figure that out. But it always has to come around the corner back to After Effects or Photoshop or whatever.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly.
So it just makes it so it's like, well, why don't we just do it all in After Effects?
Right. How about Flash? Have you worked much with Flash?
Yeah, I worked with Flash a lot. Mm-hmm. It's funny where I am now. Like I feel like there was like for a while everyone thought I hadn't ever used it because yeah. I avoid it as much as I possibly can.
Oh, you and me both.
It's just I feel here's the thing about Flash. I feel like every time to get it to do what you need it to do in production is always a compromise.
Right.
So it feels like using one of those pieces of software that you find in maybe like the App Store. Like you'll find like Fred's Animation Pro, and then you try it, and it's just not there.
Right.
There, you know, things like you can break the entire way that Flash works in After Effects if you push a camera past a SWIFT in After Effects. Like, it has these crazy, like, composition-breaking, job-ruining glitches that everything that you get out of using Flash is just better avoided.
Right.
So I always find, like, if you can use Photoshop, Illustrator, and After Effects,
yeah.
You will have a rock solid workflow.
Right.
If you start mixing SWIFTs in there, good luck.
Yeah.
Hopefully you don't have a deadline.
Yeah. When you're looking at the different tools, and you know, maybe we can sort of focus particularly on After Effects, and that's what this course will be working in as well. And I'm a big proponent of using After Effects for character as well. As you look at After Effects, or even looking at other tools like Flash sure. or Cinema or whatever, how does the tool dictate the types of movement you're trying to create, or how much do you negotiate between the tool and what you're trying to get out of the motion?
Well, I definitely try to think like how you know you have I don't know a set of 10 shots, and five of them five of those shots would have to be reasonably executed with a puppet and the same puppet. So, or else it's not practical. So what I mean is if you have like an upshot and a downshot and five straight on kind of neutral conversational shots, then it's a good workflow to use the puppets because maybe you have to do these sort of bespoke shots where it's an upshot and downshot and you have to redraw your artwork to match that.
Right.
But when you can keep the shot selection dynamic and use this puppet that's essentially one angle, that's where I find it's a really practical use for After Effects.
Right.
And I hate that sometimes I'm led by that a little bit. I find myself like picking these neutral camera positions because of that. But if you, that's why I like Element, and I've started using Element to do backgrounds almost exclusively because you can push it and go, you know, push the camera way in, get close, then you don't know what the body's going to look like and have this really dynamic background.
Yeah,
you might not have done because of the limitations of it. I feel like maybe I maybe lost track of your question there. I don't know if that.
Oh no, that's okay. I was just talking about the relationship between the software and the kind of movement you're trying to create. Like, do you kind of let that lead you, or do you? What's the negotiation? And you're discussing that.
The negotiation for me is what After Effects. Here's where you get in trouble with After Effects. After Effects loves to like bezier and spline your animation. And that is the immediate killer of good looking animation to me is anytime you're essentially letting the computer make the decision, you're kind of screwed.
Right.
So what we do a lot of things to mitigate that, which is things like adding grain and texture. I know that's a very top level change, but even things like 90% of the time, if we have an animation that kind of looks weird, if we switch it to like 12 frames per second, all of a sudden those problems are fixed.
Right.
Something about the way that these computer lines move in 24 or 30 frames looks really computery. So when I watch like something like, I'm trying to think of an example of a show I really think does a kind of Wonder Pets is funny. It's one I've been referencing for years because of the way they handle stuff is so great. And then I'm always like, man, if that was at 12 frames per second, the show would look so much better. You know, it's that kind of a thing because...
Right.
You get into these it's the way After Effects interpolates your decisions is probably the hardest thing to deal with. Mm-hmm. So when I have a guy start out, I'll often make them use only hold frames.
Right.
Absolutely no splines, because it gets them out of the mindset of thinking that A to B over 10 frames is somehow okay for the computer to decide. It'll just look bad.
Right, right.
I mean, now obviously, if you know what you're doing, it doesn't matter. You'll know if your taste is there, you'll just fix it and it'll be fine. Mm-hmm. But that's what I find the one of the harder things about it is negotiating what the computer does by default.
Right,
because
right.
You're constantly having to set and fix After Effects so that it's not doing the work for you.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So when you do approach a sequence of animation, what's kind of your process? Do you start with thumbnail sketches? Do you actually get up and act things out? Or how do you kind of begin approaching a sequence of animation?
Well, especially with puppets, I always find the most important thing is to get your shot selection right. Mm. So I always start with thumbing out positions, where the guy's going to stand, medium close-up, getting the story right, yeah. And that's all drawn. I mean, I'm a big fan of Photoshop and Premiere or After Effects for doing animatics. I think your animatic is where you'll end up doing most of the planning. And if you don't feel like the animatic is working, then you're probably starting too soon.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So that's kind of the main thing. Like, I really like pretty storyboards, and maybe that's kind of just because I spend a lot of time drawing them on paper. Mm-hmm. So I don't like doing storyboards in Flash. I don't like doing storyboards. Even in Storyboard Pro is pretty great for drawing, but I love texture and color, and tones. You know, I like adding that in, but it's unnecessary. But what I feel like is if you spend a lot of time falling in love with your storyboards and your animatic process, then mm-hmm. you're just going to have a better product. So that would be like step one is locking that animatic. And that can be, you know, on a show, just trying to think of perfect examples of shows that I've worked on, but something like Trip Tank, which is very get through it and, mm-hmm. and rough, you can get away with very limited, here's the shot, here's the shot, here's the shot, and that's your whole animatic, and just make sure you get the timing right. Mm-hmm. But on BoJack, when you're shipping something, you want to make sure that your animatic is super tight and almost every pose is in there.
Right.
So that's the thing is you basically, every project is going to have a different kind of set of needs. But I think making sure that you can watch an animatic and it's not boring or it's telling the story and it's not undermining the story you're trying to tell, that is the most important step one. And then if you're using puppets, I mean, what's great about that is if you get the rough feel in mm-hmm. there for an animatic, mm-hmm. You can just straight ahead the animation. I mean that's not a great lesson for me to teach, but like what I would say is if you have the puppets right and you have your animatic locked, you could say block your poses, go like mm-hmm. like every, I don't know, you could do a pose every, I don't know, 2 or 3 seconds and get away with a lot of that keeps it alive, right. Because the problem is if you don't want to plan it out too much when you have the schedule, you spend your whole life planning and then you don't actually get the work done. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I feel like if you do a little extra on the animatic, it lets you dig into After Effects and do it all. It's not really straightforward, but almost. Straight ahead,
right,
but
right.
almost straight ahead. You know, if you plan with the animatic, it allows you to kind of be lazy about some of that. Mm-hmm. Key planning that you would have to do otherwise.
Right, right, right.
But if you skip that step, you're going to get into, I feel like that's where you get in trouble with After Effects is like trying to do your camera on the go or that kind of stuff will really get you in trouble.
Sure, sure. How do you break down the key poses for a complicated sequence? How do you figure out where those key poses need to be to make a movement happen?
Well, that is where that's where you kind of when I say all this sort of straight ahead stuff, I am more talking about performance. You know, someone,
sure.
Let's say you had someone saying, I'm going to walk over there and get that. Here I go.
Right.
You can storyboard out with these puppets. You could say in the animatic, I'm just going to have him stand there and say the first part, and then I'm going to move it in the animatic and show that he's over here. You pretty much then have to go through with After Effects and put those, you know, a global movement. So maybe right. you'd have a puppet on a null and the null would be position one, position four, or position one, two, and three, mm-hmm. Keyed out, you know,
right.
with like a hold key. So you know that puppet's going to be here, here, here. And then that's kind of enough planning to then go in and just flesh that out. Rather
sure.
than traditionally, you're keying out every, I mean, almost three or two or three frames sometimes.
Right.
You know, that's a lot of keys. But you know what I'm saying? Like it used to be that your keys were so important because you had to keep things on model and because you had to keep things moving from place to place.
Right.
Keyframing's incredibly important, but you can get away with keeping it in your head rather than having to articulate each key pose. And then that's maybe bad advice because you can get lazy, which is what you want to avoid. But but that is kind of the idea with these puppets, is getting this stuff done quickly.
Right, sure. Yeah, absolutely. And that brings us right around to what you started with, talking about being the most important thing, and I certainly agree, which is the performance of the character I always say to my students that animation is a performing art. It's a performance through a puppet or through drawings or through whatever, but it is essentially a performance. So how do you think about that aspect of it? How do you think about creating a performance with your characters?
Well, I remember for a long time, you know, when I was a lot younger, I would listen to writers talk about how they talk about how character that they had written almost like they didn't know what was going to happen. So they would say, I can't wait to put this person in this situation. And my brain that, you know, I don't know, it's my teenage brain would go, come on, man, you draw, you just write it. You know, like, why are you acting like this is something out of your head?
Right.
But in a way, once you set limits on what a character does, then all of a sudden something becomes something that character does or doesn't do. And that, I think, is the most important thing even before you start. The reason I'm using the writing thing is because it's almost like you ask questions about the character. Is this a character who would jump when he was happy?
Right.
And that answer has to be 100% yes or 100% no in your head. You need to know like what this character does. And I think that is more about kind of how you plan for puppets. You know, because what I think you run into a lot of the time with puppet animation is everyone gets the same treatment.
Right, yeah.
And you got to think about... one actually really good trick, because I guess I'm speaking, I'll leave the high-end stuff for people who do that all day long. But like for when you're going quickly with it, which I think is the goal with After Effects, is you want to set up, some people like to set up a series of how do I say it, like poses that you'll hit. Mm-hmm. So the character will scratch its head or rub its leg. But I think it's important not to have a toolbox that works for every character. I think you have to have that works for all characters. You need to have a toolbox that works for each individual character. So it's good to say, like, is this a character who touches their face when they're nervous? That's those kinds of questions. And it's yes or no, and make sure that in the scene, you don't have two people who do that.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's more about setting up kind of limits of what you think this person will do. And if you're working in a team, I think that should be reflected in the storyboards. Is this a guy who speaks with his hands? Mm-hmm. So that's a really good way. So if you want to get into it and you say, okay, I gotta hurry. I don't have a lot of time. I want this character to have a lot of personality. So he's a guy who speaks with his hands. That's your guy that speaks with his hands. Then you have another character. This guy shakes when he gets excited.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
And you can tell that with its body or its shoulders or its hand positions. And I think making sure you kind of go, okay, I'm gonna make these choices ahead of time and always remember to hit those beats.
Right.
Is the difference between a performance that's just kind of doing it or not. You know, I watch a show like Archer, which is, I mean, one of my absolute favorites, and a big inspiration of how I set stuff up and mixtures of 3D and 2D. They kind of do quick animation right in so many ways. It's the ultimate mixture of smart choices and doing more than you have to do.
Right.
You know? But they you'll see a lot of the time that they speak with shoulders, like everything's like mm-hmm, and then the shoulders will go up. And right. if you watch them, they do it. And maybe it's not such a good example of characters doing different stuff for each character. Like they tend to have similar actions for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But they do so much with mouth flap and shoulder shrug.
Yeah, right.
You know, and those kinds of choices are so much better than being in production and going, okay, this guy speaks with his hands and he's big and he moves around a lot. You know, that is the production leading because they're saying, listen, we can't have all these characters doing all this broad acting. So let's keep it subtle and just move the shoulders. And that's a really good directorial choice to get your show made.
Right, right, right.
And that, you know, then you can say, well, what about this character maybe just moves his shoulders a little more or doesn't do it as much, or, you know, that's when you start to get into individual characters. But but it's important to have this kind of this language of the world you're creating. So if you have you don't want to have like a guy made of sort of rubber hose stretchy stuff keeping small and subtle, because otherwise it'll look weird that his arms are bending, you know?
Right, right.
I don't know if I don't know if that.
Yeah, no, that absolutely.
I feel like I ramble.
No. This is gold. This stuff. You just have no idea. This kind of stuff just is so great for the students to hear. So no, this is everything you're saying is fantastic. We talked a little bit about rigging earlier, and you said that, you know, it's sort of become Shadow Machine there, kind of your part of your directing job is to create these rigs. How far do you take the rigs? How do you determine how far to take the rig?
Well, I think it always comes down to the style of the design.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the time we do a lot of these phone calls on Trip Tank. That means every episode we'll have three new characters.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very subtle. They're usually like waist up kind of stuff. Sometimes we go a little further, but in that case, the rigging is like IK arms and maybe the torso will have not even an IK, just a little bit of movement to it.
Yeah.
And then the face will be articulate. And that's kind of how we decide. It's sort of like, what does this character need to do is how far we're going to take it. So there's a character called Animal Hitman on Trip Tank, and he is like a film noir comic book style guy. Sort of looks a little bit like he could exist in, I forget the name of the movie. Sin City. You know, he's sort of got a Sin City kind of vibe.
Yeah.
And that character is more of like a turning rig. So I think you helped me out a lot with that one. And that it would be incredible overkill for almost anything but that character who has to turn and shoot and look certain ways. Even things like, so we're rigging characters right now that have to switch sides. And in a perfect world, we'd come up with a way to rig it so that you could flop looking left to right.
Mm-hmm.
But being pragmatic, it just makes more sense to have him act to the left and then push scale to negative 100% when he needs to turn, you know? And that's just a get it done kind of decision.
Right.
Maybe one day they'll figure out a way to push a button and have all that math reverse itself.
Right, right.
But right now I think it's sometimes you got to just get it done, you know?
Sure, sure.
So if you're not kind of thinking cleverly along those lines, you spend all your life in these rigs if you wanted to.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think it's kind of, you always should ask yourself, like, how much motion is this going to make? Mm-hmm. Or how much motion is this going to need?
Right.
And what's the fastest way to get from here to there?
Right,
so
right.
I think you get a lot out of making a face rig really developed because you can do so much with the face.
Right.
But you start to, it's diminishing returns if you're, you know, flopping a character from left to right when you can just push scale on negative 100 kind of thing.
Sure, sure, absolutely. Well, obviously we all use and love Duik. Are there any other plugins or scripts that you love that are your favorite?
I mean, it's so funny. Like, I think probably everyone... everything I would mention would probably be covered somewhere in one of those Andrew Kramer tutorials. things I use every day is Wiggle. You know, I know it's, and again, I think Wiggle is one of those things that's terribly misunderstood.
Yeah.
Because it's the quickest way to tell someone that you haven't thought it through, because it's too much or too little or too varied. You know, I think using a seed random, you know, that one where you basically tell it what random seed to use, and then a Wiggle. You can. Here's where people get stuck with Wiggle. They'll want a camera to look handheld, and so they'll put it on the position of the camera. But if you're holding a camera, you don't move in the Z-axis. You're standing there and you wobble from side to side and maybe up and down a little bit.
Right, right.
So the quick way around that is like if you put a Wiggle on the position of a camera, all of a sudden you're going to be moving in and out, and everyone's going to know, okay, that's a digital camera, because cameras don't do that. But if you put a Wiggle on, say, the orientation of the camera, then all of a sudden, and it's very subtle, then all of a sudden you are someone who's trying to keep a camera locked on somebody.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and it's little things like that that end up being I use every day is getting a camera to have a sympathetic and nice movement. Mm-hmm. Camera animation, I think, is probably the hardest thing to do in After Effects, but the biggest payoff if you get it right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So stuff like wiggle I know it sounds like such an obvious one, but it's I would say get it right, you know, mm-hmm. like figure out how to make that wiggle work because it's probably the most handy thing if you use it properly.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I use what's in my toolbox? Grain. I put grain on almost everything for no other reason than it gets rid of banding, which color banding will send it back from the color correction place. We'll send the show back for banding. things like working in 16-bit is really smart.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with where computers are at right now.
Right.
It's almost no point in working in 8-bit.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I love trap code. I do mm-hmm. so much stuff with particulars is invaluable. I couldn't work without that. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think. Duik, obviously. Duik is great because they give you, nowadays, he's got almost every script you use built in. You just push the button, which is super handy. He's like, he's a maniac. I don't know what he's doing.
Well, I know. Have you seen what's coming with Duik 15?
Yeah, it was just on the beta. Lord. I gave him so much money. I was like, I got to pay this guy.
Yeah, I did too. I felt exactly the same way. Please take my money. Yeah.
but yeah, like Duik, if you have Duik, I feel like all your expressions are covered.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of these little nuggets that make my life easier. But I think it's that. You know, things like don't get too caught up in things like vignettes until you know how to not make them banned or not make them obvious.
They're great.
I think it's, you know what it is? Here's the main thing that I think if someone asks what I try to do in After Effects is make it look analog. So every single thing I do is it looks as real as possible.
Right, right.
And now obviously I'm saying that, there's no way to mix real stock footage into this kind of stuff. But I try to think, how would optical printing work with this? How would this look? A good example I see a lot is blend states. So if you have multiply or add or screen.
Right.
I feel what a lot of people get wrong, especially when they're starting out, is things like additive effects. Mm-hmm. So you'll get a fire layer and you'll put it on at 100% and then turn it to add instead of say screen.
Right.
And then it destroys pixels. So you have these big giant areas of white and nobody wants to see that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's where you start to have, you know, people can get a lot of mileage out of screen or turning the opacity down. Or one thing this is a top tip because I do it for everything to the point where my team laughs at me. Whenever we're done, I get the glow effect, you know, stylized glow.
Yeah.
And just turn it up to 1,000. And then, not the size, not the intensity.
Oh, sure.
but what it does is it smooths out all the pixels in your whole thing and keeps things alive. So you end up getting this kind of airy feeling to everything. So everything looks like maybe there's a little light kind of blooming into it.
Oh, nice. Oh, I'm going to have to try that one.
Yeah, but I mean, essentially what you want to do is you want to get it to a point where if you turned it on and off, you go, what is it doing? You know, because when I say that, you'll get yourself in trouble if you just turn glow on, makes everything look like shit.
Right, right, right.
But if you turn it on and then to crank the whatever radius, I guess, to 500 even or 1,000, depending, you get this really, what it does is it brings the blacks up a little bit and pushes the colors all close together. So you get this kind of free color correction pass, which is really nice.
Interesting. Oh, that's a great tip. I love that one.
But that's me looking for analog, you know?
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, absolutely. That's great. So when you're looking at new young character animators coming into your studio, what's the biggest mistake or kind of bad habit you kind of see again and again?
Well, probably with digital, it's letting the computer do the work.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Anytime I see that, I'm automatically, you sort of lose a point. people who stand out are the ones who know about paths of action and what the difference between too much and too little, you know, an overperformance is as bad as an underperformance. And a little bit of rock and roll is nice, but some things are too shaky, too janky, you know, it just doesn't work.
Right.
But the main thing is someone who has a focus on something. So if I see somebody who's got a little bit of every little program and then hasn't say, nailed character animation, I almost don't know what to do with that person.
Right, right.
Whereas if they have really tight camera, or sorry, they have really tight, here's a perfect example. If someone had nice character animation and then terrible camera, right. I'd be like, well, I don't know what to do with you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But if they focus on character animation, okay, that's a person who's come on the team and be an awesome part of the team and they know how to character animate.
Right.
Or their compositing's really tight. Okay, I can work with that.
Right.
It's that kind of a thing. To me, and this is where I might sound like a snob, but to me, a lot of the time it comes down to drawing, because I feel like people who draw have been spending their whole lives thinking about this stuff.
Uh-huh, right.
Because it's like, you know, even your whole life drawing is key posing. You know,
right.
You have to draw a guy or a girl or a thing or an animal that is doing something that you have to get from that one drawing.
Right.
So he's reaching for a drink.
Right.
You're drawing that your whole life. Then all of a sudden you kind of understand key poses.
Sure, right.
So that's a lot of the time, like, you can tell where people who can draw end up having a real leg up.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. Do you find it hard to find good, maybe I should ask a two-part question. Is it hard to find good character animators in general?
Yeah.
And then maybe the subset to that is it hard to find good After Effects character animators?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like yes, and then times one and a half, you know. So it's like definitely hard to find good character animators. I think it's a skill that's hard to learn, and people can. I think the industry and the schooling can make you lazy about that. They don't focus on how important performance is and character nailing those characters is, because you kind of almost have to do it instinctively.
Right.
Or you get to that level, you know, that whole joke about 10,000 hours thing, where you have to get good at it. You want to feel like that person has done their 10,000 hours on something like performance. And I mean, I love teaching people and giving people a shot. You just want to make sure that the roots are there.
Right.
So, you know, I can work, to be honest, here's the thing. If you are an After Effects guru, you're going to be great for coding and compositing.
Right.
But if you're a character animation guru, I can show you After Effects.
Right. Yeah. Well, and so how do you know when you're looking at someone's portfolio or their demo reel? What are you looking for that tells you, aha, here's somebody that I can work with. I can develop their.
Well, you know, someone who's like taking someone who has some character animation on their reel, and I don't care what it is. I mean, it can be After Effects or it can be hand drawn. But then, you know, maybe they have a shot or two that they've taken a puppet they found on the internet and animated that.
Right.
You know, starting with a rig is great. Or, you know, make a little scene from a film and focus on the performance. And I know that that's sort of I think a lot of people do that.
Sure.
But what you want to do, how do I say it? How to package yourself is to tell the person who's looking at it what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So the mistake I see all the time is someone's like, okay, here's my reel. I did a little lighting, a little character, a little rigging, a little of this. I'm like, well, what are you? You know,
right.
If you've been in a school that's, you know, you've had, because when I went to Sheridan, the focus was make your film, no teams.
Right.
And the reason they did that is because you get in real trouble with a team of five and four people are doing one thing and another person's doing the heavy lifting.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I feel like you need to package yourself as a character animator. If that's the job you want, you make sure that you have a couple different styles. Maybe 3D, sure. I mean, that's going to get you a big job. But make sure that you haven't forgotten about 2D, even if it's cut out, you know?
Right.
But I mean, it just seems like, especially like entry level positions, if you can nail character animation in After Effects, then all of a sudden you're someone who can work with essentially a compromised tool set, you know, with respect. After Effects is kind
sure.
of, we're asking it to do things it never wanted to do.
Right. No, you're right. Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, you'll go to a company and you'll work on, say, Archer or something, and those guys will all have these crazy rigs, and you're just basically moving sliders around.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. When you were, back in the day when you were coming up and learning, was there something you wish somebody had told you? Was there something you wish somebody had pulled you aside and said, here is the great secret that will solve all your problems? Was there anything like that? Anything that you would tell a young character animator kind of just getting started?
I mean, I think the main thing is to focus on making people... Focus on the thing that's going to make you stand out. And the only reason to do that is because people, you need to stand out. Mm-hmm. So if it's, you know, I feel like I always had a bit of a leg up because no matter what, I knew that I could draw something that would make certain people go, oh, he's a good drawer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all that did was make people click. You know, it was a thing. It was like a foot in the door.
Right.
So, you know, like I worked with a documentary filmmaker and he would always mention that I could draw and I could never figure out why, but I think it was the thing that separated me from someone else. You know, it was the thing that it was like saying he can sing, you know, it's like a thing that you can point to.
Right.
So it's whether it's drawing or performance or packaging and by packaging, I mean polishing a composite or something mm-hmm. like that.
Right.
Or, you know, someone who's an amazing rigger.
Right.
You know, make some crazy rig that'll blow someone's mind.
Right, right.
And
right.
put it out on the internet. Give it away. You know,
right.
Like, this is, it's funny because I nowadays on the internet, I've seen a lot of people pushing, like, don't work for free. Don't do anything for free. Don't work for free.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really good advice if you're established. But it's terrible advice if you're not.
Right, yeah.
Because, you know, I don't know anyone who didn't start by doing a favor for someone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to be very careful about what you do for free.
Sure.
And essentially, if you saw how much the grant I got was compared to how much I spent to make Rumbleseed, I made that for free.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
So, sure. I mean, yeah. I think that's a really important starting out lesson is make the thing or do the thing that makes people go, oh, I gotta hire that guy.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
Like
yeah,
I saw
great.
A reel for a CalArts guy who is really, he was really good.
Mm-hmm.
His Path of Action, it was amazing. He clearly knew all this stuff, design and a character. It was all great, great, great. Right. He ended up watching Trip Tank and I think was offended by the content. But and so he said, no thanks. But it was like one of those, hey, this is all great. Let's do this. And then he watched the show and then maybe it had too many dick jokes or something, but
that's too bad.
Yeah, but he nailed it because he had a couple of character pieces and some design, and the character pieces were impeccable.
Yeah,
and the design was there, you know. So I was like, okay, well, he could definitely do two things.
Right, right, yeah, right, right, yeah.
Because essentially, and if you're not going to be the best in the world, you got to do more than one thing.
Right, right, or you have to be the very best at the one thing that you do.
Yeah, I mean, I like there's a guy I know. Who works for Blue Sky, and he essentially he animates the characters in 2D, then shows that to the 3D guys and says, do it like this.
Wow.
And
wow.
It's such an amazing, and when you watch those Blue Sky films, they're so well animated with
yeah.
the squash and stretch and the movement that they get out of these characters is like, I would say that's their killer app. You know,
right.
If you watch like, you know, Madagascar, the birds, Rio. If you watch
right.
Rio 2, the stuff that they're making those puppets do is insane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever you think about the film, but
yeah.
the classical, the characters is
yeah.
so good. And he's essentially one of the best 2D animators working.
Wow.
And he'd be a nightmare in a lot of studios because of that.
Mm-hmm.
But because he's the best in the world, doesn't matter. You
right,
know what I mean?
Right,
he can go
right.
and do his thing. And everyone's like, holy shit. He's like he's a master. He's an absolute master.
Right,
you know?
Right.
He's making Stradivarius violins.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I had no idea that was being that animation was being driven by a 2D animator. That's amazing. That's,
yeah,
that's
and he
really
was,
cool.
He was always the best guy in my class. You know.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Oh, that's super cool. Are you guys working on anything at Shadow Machine that you can talk about? Anything new and fun?
Yeah, right now we're doing Trip Tank, which is the, mm-hmm. it was 8 seasons last year on Comedy
wow.
Central. Now we got 20 coming up in the fall, I think.
Oh, great.
And that is like, it's an anthology, so it's like 50 sketches, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think we have 80 or maybe it's 150 sketches for all I know.
Right, right.
And our team's responsible for the interstitials, which kind of glue the sketches together. So it's a guy, right. two couple of guys answering the phones apparently
right.
at Trip Tank.
At
know?
Trip Tank, yeah.
And then, you know, I've got a couple of my sort of the pet projects that they kindly let me include, which is Animal Hitman. It's about a guy who, you know, gets rid of your unwanted animals. That's what I'm specifically working on. I just finished directing 2 episodes of BoJack Horseman
right,
for Netflix, which was super great. Great show. Like, very
yeah.
proud of that one.
Yeah.
And that comes out in July. They just announced it on Netflix. And I also did, I did the title sequence for season 1. And then as a kind of thank you, they gave me a couple episodes to direct of season 2, which is great.
Fantastic. That's great. Great. Wonderful. Well, great. This has just been fantastic, Mike. Really some amazing golden nuggets of knowledge that you've dropped on our students. I really, really appreciate you taking the time. No, there was pure gold, really, all the way through. Really, that was fantastic. So I really appreciate you taking the time talking to us, and wish you all the best with your future endeavors.
Yeah, of course. Thanks so much for listening.
One of the things that's so impressive about Mike's work is that he's really a complete filmmaker. He understands the big picture, but he also understands the minutiae and the little details and all the little components that make an animated production tick. He's also technically very, very skilled, as you could hear from some of the great tips and tricks he was offering in terms of using After Effects. Also nice that he, like me, is sort of an enthusiastic user of After Effects for character animation. He kind of has echoed many of my feelings about why After Effects is such a good choice for doing this kind of work. I think Mike's varied background is really interesting as well, and you can see how that background informs the work he does. And I love that he emphasized the importance of performance in doing character animation work. Mike's website is michaeljohnroberts.com, and you can also find Shadow Machine at shadowmachine.com.